The sentries, he inquired. Are we at war? She did not understand. War? Are we fighting against people? Fighting? She asked doubtfully. The men fight sometimes about their wives and that. Of course there is no bloodshed, only scuffling to find the better man. Is that what you mean? No. I meant fighting against armies, against other geese, for instance. She was amused at this.
How ridiculous. You mean a lot of geese all scuffling at the same time? It would be amusing to watch.
Her tone surprised him.
Amusing? To watch them kill each other? To kill each other? An army of geese? To kill each other?
She began to understand the idea very slowly and doubtfully, an expression of grief and distaste coming over her face. When it had sunk in, she left him. She went away to another part of the field in silence. He followed her, but she turned her back. Moving round to get a glimpse of her eyes, he was startled by their abhorrence, a look as if he had made an obscene suggestion. He said lamely,
I'm sorry. You do not understand. Leave talking about it.
I'm sorry. Later he added, A person can ask, I suppose. It seems a natural question, with the sentries. But she was thoroughly angry, almost tearful.
Will you stop about it at once? What a horrible mind you must have. You have no right to say such things, and of course there are sentries. There are the gerfalcons and the peregrines, are there not? The foxes and the ermines and the humans with their nets. These are natural enemies. But what creature could be so low and treacherous as to murder the people of its blood?
He thought, it is a pity that there are no big creatures to prey on humanity. If there were enough dragons and rocks, perhaps mankind would turn its might against them. Unfortunately, man is preyed upon by microbes, which are too small to be appreciated. Out loud, he said, I was trying to learn. She relented with an obvious effort to be good-natured. She wanted to be broad-minded if she could, as she was rather a blue stocking.
You have a long way to go.
Then you must teach me. You must tell me about the goose people, so that I improve my mind. She was doubtful after the shock which he had given her, but her heart was not a malicious one. Like all the geese, she had a mildness which found forgiving easy. Soon they were friends.
What would you like to know?
He discovered in the next few days, for they spent much time together, that Liuliok was a charming person. She had told him her name at the beginning of their acquaintance and had advised him to have one of his own. They had chosen Kikwor, a distinguished title taken from the rare red-breasted geese whom she had met in Siberia. Afterwards, once they were on name terms, she had buckled to his education manfully. Liuliok's mind did not run upon flirtation only. She took a rational interest in the wide world in her prudent way, and although she was puzzled by his questions, she learned not to be disgusted by them. Most of these questions were based on his experience among the ants, and that was why they puzzled her. He wanted to know about nationalism, about state control, individual liberty, property and so forth, the things whose importance had been mentioned in the combination room, or which he had noticed in the anthill. As most of these things had to be explained to her before she could explain herself, there were interesting things to talk about. They conversed amiably, and as his education prospered, the surprised old man began to feel a sort of deep humility and even an affection for her geese, rather like the feelings which Gulliver must have had among the horses. No, she explained to him, there was no state control among the grey people. They had no communal possessions, nor did they make a claim to any part of the world. The lovely globe, they thought, could not belong to anybody except itself, and all their geese had access to its raw materials. Neither was any state discipline imposed upon the individual bird. The story of how a returning ant could be sentenced to death if it did not disgorge some food when asked for it revolted her. Among the geese, she said, everybody ate as much as he could get hold of, and if you trespassed upon an individual who had found a succulent patch of grass, he would very properly peck you soundly. And yes, she said, they did have private property besides their meals. A married couple would repair to the same nest year by year, although they might have travelled many thousand miles between. The nest was private, and so was family life. Geese, she explained, were not promiscuous in their love affairs, except in adolescence, which she believed was as it should be. When they were married for their lives. Their politics, so far as they had any, were patriarchal or individualistic, founded on free choice. And, of course, they never went to war. He asked her about the system of leadership. It was obvious that certain geese were accepted as leaders. Generally, they were venerable old gentlemen whose breasts were deeply mottled, and that these leaders flew at the head of their formations. Remembering the queen ants, who, like Borgias, slew one another for the highest place, he wondered how the captains of the geese had been elected. They were not elected, she said, not in a formal way. They simply became captains. When he pressed her on the point, she went off into a long talk about migration. This was how she put it. The first goose, she said, I suppose, who made the flight from Siberia to Lincolnshire and back again, must have brought up a family in Siberia. Then, when the winter came upon them, and it was necessary to find new food, he must have groped his way over the same route, being the only one who knew it. He will have been followed by his growing family year after year, their pilot and their admiral. When the time came for him to die, obviously the next best pilots would have been his eldest sons, who would have covered the route more often than the others. Naturally, the younger sons and fledglings would have been uncertain about it, and therefore would have been glad to follow somebody who knew. Perhaps among the eldest sons there would have been some who were notoriously muddle-headed, and the family would hardly care to trust to them. This, she said, is how an admiral is elected. Perhaps Wink Wink will come to our family in the autumn, and he will say, excuse me, but have you by any chance got a reliable pilot in your lot? Poor Grandad died at cloudberry time, and Uncle Onk is inefficient. We were looking for somebody to follow. Then we will say, Great Uncle will be delighted if you care to hitch up with us, but mind, we cannot take responsibility if things go wrong. Thank you very much, he will say. I am sure your Great Uncle can be relied upon. Do you mind if I mention this matter to the Honks, who are, I happen to know, in the same difficulty? Not at all. And that, she explained, is how Great Uncle became an admiral. It seems an excellent way. Look at his bars, she said respectfully, and they both glanced at the portly patriarch, whose breast was indeed barred with black stripes like the gold rings on an admiral's sleeve. On another occasion, he asked about the joys and ambitions of the geese. He told her, apologetically, that among the human beings, a life without spectacular acquisitions, or even without warfare, might tend to be regarded as tedious. Humans, he said, make for themselves great stores of ornaments, riches, luxuries, pleasures, and so forth. This gives them an objective in their lives. It is also said to lead to war. But I fear that if they were reduced to the minimum of possessions with which you geese are contented, they might be unhappy. They certainly would be. Their brains are differently shaped from ours.
If you tried to make the humans live exactly like the geese, they would be as wretched as the geese would be if you tried to make them live exactly like the humans. That does not mean that one of them cannot learn a little from the other.
I'm beginning to think that the geese cannot learn very much from us.
We have been on the earth for millions of years longer than you have, poor creatures, so you can hardly be blamed.
But tell me, he said, about your pleasures, your ambitions or objectives or whatever you may call them. Surely they are rather limited. She laughed at this.
Our main object in life, she said with amusement, is to be alive. I think your humans may have forgotten this one. Our pleasures, however, if they are to be compared with ornaments and riches, are not so dull as they seem. We have a song about them called The Boon of Life. Sing it.
I will in a minute. But I must say before I begin that it has always seemed a pity to me that the one great boon has been left out. The people in the song are supposed to be arguing about the joys of the geese, and nobody mentions travel. I think this is silly. We travel 100 times further than the humans, and see such interesting things, and have such delightful change and novelty all the time, that I cannot understand how the poet can have forgotten it. Why, my grandmother went to Micklegarth. I had an uncle who had been to Burma, and great-granddad used to say he had visited Cuba.
As the king knew that Micklegarth was the Scandinavian name for Constantinople, while he had only heard of Burma from T. Natrix and Cuba had not been invented at all, he was suitably impressed.
It must be heavenly, he said, to travel.
He thought of the lovely wings and of the songs of flight and of the world pouring always new and new beneath their pinions.
This is the song, she said without further preamble,
and she began to sing it gracefully to a wild goose air.
The boon of life.
Kai Yao replied, "The boon of life is health. Paddle foot, feather straight, supple neck, button eye, these have the world's wealth." Aged Ankh answered, "Honour is our all. Pathfinder, people feeder, plan provider, sage commander, these hear the high call."
Liu Liok the lightsome said, "Love I had liefer. Dance down, tender tread, warm nest and walk in line, these live forever." Ang Ung was for appetite. "Ah," he said, "eating. Gander gobble, tear grass, stubble stalk, stuff crop. These take some beating." Wink Wink praised comrades, the fair free fraternity. "Line astern, echelon, arrowhead, over cloud. These learn eternity." But I, Liao, choose lay making of loud lilts which linger. Horn music, laughter song, epic heart, ape the world. These, Liao the singer.
It was a beautiful song in a way, he thought, given with her tender gravity. He began counting the boons which she had mentioned on his toes, but as he only had 3 in front and a sort of knob behind, he had to go round twice. Travel, health, honour, love, appetite, comradeship, music, poetry, and, as she had stated, being alive itself. It did not seem a bad list in its simplicity, particularly as she might have added something like wisdom. Chapter 14. But there was a growing excitement among the host. The young geese flirted outrageously, or collected in parties to discuss their pilots. They played games also, like children excited at the prospect of a party. One of these games was to stand in a circle, while the young ganders, one after another, walked into the middle of it with their heads stretched out, pretending to hiss, When they were halfway across the circle, they would run the last part, flapping their wings. This was to show how brave they were and what excellent admirals they would make when they grew up. Also, the strange habit of shaking their bills sideways, which was usual before flight, began to grow upon them. The elders and sages who knew the migration routes became uneasy also. They kept a wise eye on the cloud formations, summing up the wind and the strength of it, and what air it was coming from. The admirals, heavy with responsibility, paced their quarter-decks with ponderous tread. "Why am I restless?" he asked. "Why do I have this feeling in my blood?" "Wait and see," she said mysteriously. "Tomorrow, perhaps, or the day after?" And her eyes assumed the expression of dreams, a look of far away and long ago. When the morrow came, there was a difference about the salt marsh and the slob. The ant-like man, who had walked out so patiently every day to his long nets, with the tides fixed firmly in his head, because to make a mistake in them was certain death, heard a far bugle in the sky. He saw no thousands on the mud flats, and there were none in the pastures from which he had come. He was a nice little man in his way, for he stood still solemnly and took off his hat. He did this every spring religiously when the wild geese left him, and every autumn when he saw the first returning gaggle. "How far is it across the North Sea?" "In a steamer it takes us 2 or 3 days, so many hours of slobbering through the viscous water. But for the geese, for the sailors of the air, for the angled wedges of heaven tearing clouds to tatters, for those singers of the Empyrean with the gale behind them, 70 miles an hour behind another 70, for those mysterious geographers 3 miles up, they say, with cumulus for their floor instead of water, what was it for them? One thing it was, and that was joy. The king had never seen his friends so gleeful. The songs they sang, hour after hour, were mad with it. Some were vulgar, which we shall have to leave for another time. Some were sagas beautiful beyond comparison. Some were light-hearted to a degree. One silly one which amused him was as follows. "We wander the sky with many a cronk, and land in the pasture fields with a plonk, hank, hank, hink, hink, honk, honk. Then we bend our necks with a curious kink, like the bend which the plumber puts under the sink, honk, honk, hank, hank, hink, hink. And we feed away in a sociable rank, tearing the grass with a sideways yank, hink, hink, honk, honk, hank, hank. But hink or honk, we relish the plonk, and honk or hank, we relish the rank, and hank or hink, we think it a jink to honk or hank or hink." A sentimental one was, "Wild and free, wild and free, bring back my gander to me, to me." While when they were passing over a rocky island populated by barnacle geese, who all looked like spinsters in black leather gloves, grey toques and jet beads, the entire squadron burst out derisively with, "Brantabernicles, it's a-slumming in the slob! Brantabernicles, it's a-slumming in the slob! Brantabernicles, it's a-slumming in the slob! While we go sauntering on! Glory, glory, here we go, dear! Glory, glory, here we go, dear! Glory, glory, here we go, dear! To the North Pole sauntering along!" But it is no good trying to tell about the beauty. It was just that life was beautiful beyond belief, and that is a kind of joy which has to be lived. Sometimes, when they came down from the cirrus levels to catch a better wind, they would find themselves among the flocks of cumulus, huge towers of mottled vapour, looking as white as Monday's washing and as solid as meringues. Perhaps one of these piled-up blossoms of the sky, these snow-white droppings of a gigantic Pegasus, would lie before them several miles away.
they would set their course towards it, seeing it grow bigger silently and imperceptibly, a motionless growth. And then, when they were at it, when they were about to bang their noses with a shock against its seeming solid mass, the sun would dim. Wraiths of mist, suddenly moving like serpents of the air, would coil about them for a second. Grey damp would be around them, and the sun, a copper penny, would fade away. The wings next to their own wings would shade into vacancy, until each bird was a lonely sound in cold annihilation, a presence after uncreation. And there they would hang in chartless nothing, seemingly without speed or left or right or top or bottom, until as suddenly as ever the copper penny glowed and the serpents writhed. Then, in a moment of time, they would be in the jeweled world once more, a sea under them like turquoise, and all the gorgeous palaces of heaven new created, with the dew of Eden not yet dry. One of the peaks of the migration came when they passed a rock cliff of the ocean. There were other peaks when, for instance, their line of flight was crossed by an Indian file of Buick swans who were off to Abisko, making a noise as they went like little dogs barking through handkerchiefs, or when they overtook a horned owl plodding manfully along among the warm feathers of whose back, so they said, a tiny wren was taking her free ride. But the lonely island was the best of all, for it was a town of birds. They were all hatching, all quarrelling, all friendly nevertheless. On top of the cliff, where the short turf was, there were myriads of puffins busy with their burrows. Below them, in Razorbill Street, the birds were packed so close and on such narrow ledges that they had to stand with their backs to the sea, holding tight with long toes. In Guillemot Street, below that, the guillemots held their sharp, toy-like faces upwards, as thrushes do when hatching. Lowest of all, there were the Kittiwake slums, and all the birds, who, like humans, only laid one egg each, were jammed so tight that their heads were interlaced, had so little of this famous living space of ours that, when a new bird insisted upon landing at a ledge which was already full, one of the other birds had to tumble off. Yet they were all in such good humour, all so cheerful and cocknified and teasing one another. They were like an innumerable crowd of fishwives on the largest grandstand in the world, breaking out into private disputes, eating out of paper bags, chipping the referee, singing comic songs, admonishing their children and complaining of their husbands. "Move over a bit, Auntie," they said, or "shove along, Grandma. There's that Flossie gone and sat on the shrimps. Put the toffee in your pocket, dearie, and blow your nose. Lawks, if it isn't Uncle Albert with the beer. Any room for a little un? There goes Aunt Emma, fallen off the ledge. Is me hat on straight? Crikey, if this isn't half a do." They kept more or less to their own kind, but they were not mean about it. Here and there, in Guillemot Street, there would be an obstinate Kittiwake sitting on a projection and determined to have her rights. Perhaps there were 500,000 of them, and the noise they made was deafening. The king could not help wondering how a human town of mixed races would get on in such conditions. Then there were the fjords and islands of Norway. It was about one of these islands, by the way, that the great W. H. Hudson related a true goose story which is liable to make one think. There was a coastal farmer, he tells us, whose islands suffered under a nuisance of foxes. So he set up a fox trap on one of them. When he visited the trap the next day, he found that an old wild goose had been caught in it, obviously a grand admiral because of his toughness and his heavy bars. This farmer took the goose home alive, pinioned it, bound up its leg, and turned it out with his own ducks and poultry in the farmyard. Now, one of the effects of the fox plague was that the farmer had to lock his hen house at night. He used to go round in the evening to drive them in, and then he would lock the door. After a time, he began to notice a curious circumstance, which was that the hens, instead of having to be collected, would be found waiting for him in the hut. He watched the process one evening and discovered that the old wild goose had taken upon himself the responsibility which he had with his own intelligence observed. Every night at locking-up time, the sagacious old admiral would round up his domestic comrades, whose leadership he had assumed, and would prudently assemble them in the proper place by his own efforts, as if he had fully understood the situation. Nor did the free wild geese, his sometime followers, ever again settle on the other island, previously a haunt of theirs, from which their judicious captain had been spirited away. Last of all, beyond the islands, there was the landing at their first day's destination. Oh, the whiffling of delight and self-congratulation! They tumbled down out of the sky, side-slipping, stunting, even doing spinning nosedives. They were terrifically proud of themselves and of their pilot, agog for the family pleasures which were in store. They planed for the last part on down-curved wings. At the last moment they scooped the wind with them, flapping them vigorously. Next, bump, they were on the ground. They held their wings above their heads for a moment, then folded them up with a quick and pretty neatness. They had crossed the North Sea. Chapter 15. The Siberian bogland, which they reached a few days later, was a bowl of sunlight. Its mountains still retained a lacework of snow, which, as it melted, brought the little rivers down in a spate like ale. The lakes glittered under clouds of mosquitoes, and among the stunted birch trees round their margins, the amiable reindeer wandered curiously, snuffling at the goose nests while the geese hissed back at them. Liu Yok settled down at once to build her nursery, although unmarried, and the king had time to think. He was an uncritical man, certainly not a bitter one. The treachery to which he had been subjected by his human race had only just begun to weigh upon him. He had never put it in plain terms to himself, but the truth was that he had been betrayed by everybody, even by his own wife and by his oldest friend. His son was the least of the traitors. His table had turned on him, or half of it had, and so had half the country for which he had been working all his life. Now they were asking him to go back into service for the men of treason, and at last he realized for the first time that to do so would mean his end. For what hope had he among mankind? They had murdered, almost invariably, every decent person who had spoken to them since the time of Socrates. They had even murdered their god. Anybody who told them the truth was the legitimate object of their treachery, and Merlin's sentence on himself was one of death. But here, he realized, among the geese, to whom murder and treason were an obscenity, he was happy and at rest. Here there was good hope for a person with a heart. Sometimes a tired man who has a religious vocation to become a monk will feel an actual yearning for the cloister, for the place where he can expand his soul like a flower and grow towards his idea of good. That is what the old man felt, with a sudden longing, except that his cloister was the sun-drenched bog. He wanted to have done with man, to settle down. To settle down with Liu Yok, for instance. It seemed to him that a weary spirit might do worse. He began comparing her wistfully with the women he had known, not always to her disadvantage. She was healthier than they were, nor had she ever had the megrims or the vapours or the hysterics. She was as healthy as himself, as strong, as able on the wing. There was nothing that he could do which she could not do, so that their community of interests would be exact. She was docile, prudent, faithful, conversable.
She was a great deal cleaner than most women, because she spent one half of the day in preening herself and the other half in water. Nor were her features disfigured by a single smear of paint. Once she had been married, she would accept no further lovers. She was more beautiful than the average woman, because she possessed a natural shape instead of an artificial one. She was graceful and did not waddle, for all the wild geese do their walking easily, and he had learned to think her plumage handsome. She would be a loving mother. He found in his old heart a warm feeling for Liu Liok, even if there was little passion. He admired her sturdy legs with the knob at the top and her neat bill. It had serrations like teeth and a large tongue which seemed to fill it. He liked her for not being in a hurry. The nest-making enthralled her, which made him watch it with pleasure. It was not an architectural triumph, but it was what was needed. She had been fussy about the tussock which she meant to choose, and then, after the situation had been finally decided, she had lined the peaty hollow, which was like some soft, damp, brown and crumbled blotting paper, or like the tan in a circus, with heather, lichens, moss, and down from her own breast. This was as soft as cobwebs. He had brought her a few bits of grass himself as a present, but they had generally been of the wrong shape. In plucking them, he had discovered by accident the wonderful universe of the bog on which they walked. For it was a miniature world, the same kind as the Japanese are said to make in bowls. No Japanese gardener has ever bred a stunted tree more like a real one than a stalk of heather is, with its regular knots along the stalk like buttonholes. There, at his feet, there were forests of gnarled trees with glades and landscapes. There was the closest moss for grass, and an undergrowth of lichens. There were fallen tree trunks lying picturesquely, and even a strange kind of flower, a minute grey-green stalk, very dry and brittle, with a scarlet blob on the end of it like sealing wax. There were microscopic toadstools, except that their umbrellas turned upwards like egg cups. And through the desiccated sylvan scene there scuttled, for rabbits and foxes, beetles of a glossy blackness which looked oily, who adjusted their wings by twirling their pointed tails. These were the dragons of the enchantment, rather than the rabbits, and they were of endless variety. Beetles as green as jewels, spiders as small as pinheads, ladybirds like red enamel. In depressions of the peat, which was resilient to the foot, there were small pools of brown water populated by sea dragons, newts and water boatmen. Here, in the wetter soil, there was a riot of mosses, each differing from the other one, some with thin red stalks and green heads, like a peculiar corn for the Lilliputians. There, where the heather had been burned by some natural agency, such as the sun shining through a dewdrop, and not by man, who chooses to burn his bogs in the springtime, when they are full of nesting birds, there was a desolation of charred stumps, with tiny snail shells, bleached white, no bigger than peppercorns. Also putty-coloured lichens like parched sponges, whose stalks were hollow when he broke them up. And there was the vastness of it, on top of its microscopic size. There was the bog smell and the clean air, which tastes so much wider on bogs. There was the sun, positively pelting it with vigour, who only slept for a couple of hours at night. And heaven defend us, there were the mosquitoes. He had often thought that it must be boring for a bird to sit on eggs. He now knew that Liu Liok would have a universe to watch before her, a whole world bustling beneath her nose. He proposed himself one afternoon, not ardently, for he had known the world too long, but gently and hopefully, when they were on the dazzling lake. Its waters, in their frame of brown, reflected the sky to a tone of even deeper blue, as blue as a blackbird's eggs, without the spots. He swam towards her with his tail high in the water, his head and neck stretched flat like a swimming snake. He told her of his sorrows, of his unworthy nature, and of his admiration. He told her how, by joining her, he hoped to escape from Merlin and the world. Liu Liok, as usual, did not seem to be surprised. She too lowered her neck and swam towards him. He was very happy when he saw the douceness of her eyes. But a dark hand came to fetch him, as you may have guessed. He found himself swept backwards, not on pinion, not migrating, but dragged down into the filthy funnel of magic. He snatched one floating feather as he vanished, and Liu Liok was before his face no more. Chapter 16.
"Now," cried the magician, almost before the traveller had materialised, "now we can begin to forge ahead with the main idea. We are beginning to see the light at last."
"Give him a chance," said the goat. "He is looking unhappy."
Merlin swept the suggestion away.
"Unhappy? Nonsense! He is perfectly well. I was saying we could begin to forge ahead."
"Communism," began the badger, who was short-sighted and wrapped up in the subject.
"No, no, we are finished with the Bolsheviks. He is in possession of the data, and we can begin to deal with might. But he must be allowed to think for himself. King, will you choose any animals you please? And I will explain to you why they do or do not go to war. There is no deception," he added, leaning forward as if to press the animals upon his hopeless victim like sweetmeats with a fascinating smile. "You can have any animals you fancy. Adders, amoebae, antelopes, apes, asses, axolotls."
"Suppose he has ants and geese," suggested the badger nervously.
"No, no, not geese. Geese are too easy. We must be fair and let him choose what he pleases. Suppose we say rooks."
"Very well," said the badger. "Rooks."
Merlin leaned back in his chair, put his fingertips together, and cleared his throat.
"The first thing," he said, "which we must do before considering examples, is to define the subject. What is war? War, I take it, may be defined as an aggressive use of might between collections of the same species. It must be between collections, for otherwise it is mere assault and battery. An attack of one mad wolf upon a pack of wolves would not be war. And then again, it must be between members of the same species. Birds preying on locusts, cats preying on mice, or even tunny preying on herring, that is, fish of one species preying upon fish of another, none of these are true examples of war. Thus, we see that there are two essentials, that the combatants should be of the one family, and that they should be of a gregarious family. We can therefore begin by dismissing all animals which are not gregarious before we search for examples of warfare in nature. Having done that, we find ourselves left with large numbers of animals such as starlings, minnows, rabbits, bees, and thousands of others. Upon beginning our search for warfare among these, however, we find a dearth of examples. How many animals can you think of which take concerted, aggressive action against groups of their own species?"
Merlin waited 2 seconds for the old man to answer, and continued with his lecture.
"Exactly. You were about to mention a few insects, man, various microbes or blood corpuscles, if these can be said to be of the same species, and then you would have been at a loss. The gross immorality of warfare is, as I mentioned before, an oddity in nature. We sit down, therefore, relieved by this fortunate coincidence of a bundle of data which might have proved too bulky, and we examine the special peculiarities of those species which do engage in hostilities. what do we find? Do we find, as Badger's famous communists would postulate, that it is the species which owns individual property that fights? On the contrary, we find that the warfaring animals are the very ones which tend to limit or to banish individual possessions. It is the ants and bees with their communal stomachs and territories, and the men with their national property, who slit each other's throats, while it is the birds with their private wives, nests and hunting grounds, the rabbits with their own burrows and stomachs, the minnows with their individual homesteads, and the lyrebirds with their personal treasure houses and ornamental pleasure grounds, who remain at peace. You must not despise mere nests and hunting grounds as forms of property. They are as much a form of property to the animals as a home and business is to man. And the important thing is that they are private property. The owners of private property in nature are pacific, while those who have invented public property go to war. This, you will observe, is exactly the opposite of the totalist doctrine. Of course, the owners of private property in nature are sometimes forced to defend their holdings against piracy by other individuals. This rarely results in bloodshed, and men themselves need not fear it, because our king has already persuaded them to adopt the principle of a police force. But you want to object that perhaps the link which binds the warfaring animals together is not the link of nationalism. Perhaps they go to war for other reasons, because they are all manufacturers, or all owners of domestic animals, or all agriculturalists like some of the ants, or because they all have stores of food. I need not trouble you with a discussion of possibilities, for you must examine them for yourself. Spiders are the greatest of manufacturers, yet do no battle. Bees have no domestic animals or agriculture, yet go to war. Many ants who are belligerent have no stores of food. By some such mental process as this, as in finding out the highest common factor in mathematics, you will end with the explanation which I have offered, an explanation which is indeed self-evident when you come to look at it. War is due to communal property, the very thing which is advocated by nearly all the demagogues who peddle what they call a new order. I have outrun my examples. We must return to the concrete instances to examine the case. Let us look at a rookery. Here is a gregarious animal like the ant, which lives together with its comrades in airy communities. The rookery is conscious of its nationalism to the extent that it will molest other rooks from distant congeries if they attempt to build in its own trees. The rook is not only gregarious, but also faintly nationalistic. But the important thing is that it does not make any claim to national property in its feeding grounds. Any adjacent field that is rich in seed or worms will be frequented not only by the rooks of this community, but also by those of all nearby communities, and indeed by the jackdaws and pigeons of the neighbourhood, without the outbreak of hostilities. The rooks, in fact, do not claim national property except to the minor extent of their nesting site, and the result is that they are free from the scourge of war. They agree to the obvious natural truth that access to raw materials must be free to private enterprise. Then, turn to the geese, one of the oldest races, one of the most cultured, one of the best supplied with language. Admirable musicians and poets, masters of the air for millions of years, without ever having dropped a bomb, monogamous, disciplined, intelligent, gregarious, moral, responsible, we find them adamant in their belief that the natural resources of the world cannot be claimed by any particular sect or family of their tribe. If there is a good bed of Zostera marina or a good field of stubble, there may be 200 geese on it today, 10,000 tomorrow. In one skein of geese, which is moving from feeding ground to resting place, we may find white fronts mingled with pink feet or grey lags or even with the barnacles. The world is free to all. Yet do not suppose that they are communists. Each individual goose is prepared to assault its neighbour for the possession of a rotten potato, while their wives and nests are strictly private. They have no communal home or stomach like the ants. And these beautiful creatures, who migrate freely over the whole surface of the globe without making claim to any part of it, have never fought a war. It is nationalism, the claims of small communities to parts of the indifferent earth as communal property, which is the curse of man. The petty and drivelling advocates of Irish or Polish nationalism, these are the enemies of man, yes, and the English, who fight a major war ostensibly for the rights of small nations, while erecting a monument to a woman who was martyred for the remark that patriotism was not good enough. These people can only be regarded as a collection of benevolent imbeciles conducted by bemused crooks. Nor is it fair to pick on the English or the Irish or the Poles. All of us are in it. It is the general idiocy of homo impoliticus. Aye, and when I speak rudely of the English in this particular, I would like to add at once that I have lived among them during several centuries. Even if they are a collection of imbecile crooks, they are at least bemused and benevolent about it, which I cannot help thinking is preferable to the tyrannous and cynical stupidity of the Huns who fight against them. Make no mistake about that.
And what, asked the badger politely, is the practical solution?
The simplest and easiest in the world. You must abolish such things as tariff barriers, passports, and immigration laws, converting mankind into a federation of individuals. In fact, you must abolish nations, and not only nations, but states also. Indeed, you must tolerate no unit larger than the family. Perhaps it will be necessary to limit private incomes on a generous scale, for fear that very rich people might become a kind of nation in themselves. That the individual should be turned into communists or anything else is quite unnecessary, however, and it is against the laws of nature. In the course of 1,000 years, we should hope to have a common language if we were lucky. But the main thing is that we must make it possible for a man living at Stonehenge to pack up his traps overnight and to seek his fortune without hindrance in Timbuktu. Man might become migratory, he added as an afterthought, with some surprise.
But this would spell disaster, exclaimed the badger. Japanese labour, trade would be undercut.
Fiddlesticks! All men have the same physical structure and need of nourishment. If a coolie can ruin you by living on a bowl of rice in Japan, you'd better go to Japan and buy a bowl of rice. Then you can ruin the coolie, who will by then, I suppose, be sporting it in London in your Rolls Royce.
But it would be the death blow of civilization. It would lower the standard of living.
Fudge! It would raise the coolie's standard of living. If he is as good a man as you are in open competition, or a better one, good luck to him. He is the man we want. As for civilization, look at it.
It would mean an economic revolution.
Would you rather have a series of Armageddons? Nothing of value was ever yet got in this world, my badger, without being paid for.
Certainly, agreed the badger suddenly. It seems the thing to do.
So there you have it. Leave man to his petty tragedy if he prefers to embrace it, and look about you at 250,000 other animals. They, at any rate, with a few trifling exceptions, have political sense. It is a straight choice between the ant and the goose, and all our king will need to do when he returns will be to make their situation obvious.
The badger, who was a faithful opponent to all kinds of exaggeration, objected strongly.
"Surely," he said, "this is a piece of muddled thinking, to say that man may choose between the ants and the geese. In the first place, man can be neither. And secondly, as we know, the ants are not unhappy as themselves."
Merlin covered his argument at once.
"I should not have said so. It was a manner of speaking. Actually, there are never more than two choices open to a species, either to evolve along its own lines of evolution, or else to be liquidated. The ants had to choose between being ants or being extinct, and the geese had to choose between extinction and being geese. It is not that the ants are wrong while the geese are right. Antism is right for ants, and goosiness is right for geese. In the same way, man will have to choose between being liquidated and being manly. And a great part of being manly lies in the intelligent solution of these very problems of force which we have been examining through the eyes of other creatures. That is what the king must try to make them see."
Archimedes coughed and said, "Excuse me, master, but is your backside clear enough today to tell us if he will succeed?"
Merlin scratched his head and wiped his spectacles.
"He will succeed in the end," he said eventually. "That I am certain of. Otherwise, the race must perish, like the American wood pigeons, who, I may add, were considerably more numerous than the human family, yet became extinct in the course of a dozen years at the end of the 19th century. But whether it is to be this time or another is still obscure to me. The difficulty of living backwards and thinking forwards is that you become confused about the present. It is also the reason why one prefers to escape into the abstract."
The old gentleman folded his hands upon his stomach, toasted his feet at the fire, and, reflecting upon his own predicament in time, began to recite from one of his favourite authors.
"I saw," he quoted, "the histories of mortal men of many different races being enacted before my eyes. Kings and queens and emperors and republicans and patricians and plebeians swept in reverse order across my view. Time rushed backward in tremendous panoramas. Great men died before they won their fame. Kings were deposed before they were crowned. Nero and the Borgias and Cromwell and Asquith and the Jesuits enjoyed eternal infamy and then began to earn it. My motherland melted into barbaric Britain. Byzantion melted into Rome. Venice into Henetian Altino. Hellas into innumerable migrations. Blows fell and then were struck."
In the silence which succeeded this impressive picture, the goat returned to an earlier topic.
"He is looking unhappy," said he, "whatever you may say."
So they looked at the king for the first time since his return, and fell silent. Chapter 17. He was watching them with the feather in his hand. He held it out unconsciously, his fragment of beauty. He kept them off with it, as if it were a weapon to hold them back.
"I am not going," he said. "You must find another ox to draw for you. Why have you brought me away? Why should I die for man, when you speak of him contemptuously yourselves? For it would be death. It is all too true that people are ferocious and stupid. They have given me every sorrow but death. Do you suppose that they will listen to wisdom, that the dullard will understand and throw down his arms? No, he will kill me for it, kill me as the ants would have killed an albino."
"And Merlin," he cried, "I am afraid to die, because I have never had a chance to live. I never had a life of my own, nor time for beauty, and I had just begun to find it. You show me beauty and snatch it from me. You move me like a piece of chess. Have you the right to take my soul and twist it into shapes, to rob a mind of its mind?
Oh, animals, I have failed you, I know. I have betrayed your trust. But I cannot face the collar again, because you have driven me into it too long. Why should I leave Yoliok? I was never clever, but I was patient, and even patience goes. Nobody can bear it all his life.
They did not dare to answer, could think of nothing to say. His feeling of guilt and of love frustrated had made him wretched, so that now he had to rage in self-defense.
Yes, you are clever. You know the long words and how to juggle with them. If the sentence is a pretty one, you laugh and make it. But these are human souls you are cackling about, and it is my soul, the only one I have, which you have put in the index. And Yoliok had a soul. Who made you into gods to meddle with destiny, or set you over hearts to bid them come and go? I will do this filthy work no longer. I will trouble with your filthy plans no further. I will go away into some quiet place with the goose people, where I can die in peace.
His voice broke down into that of an old and miserable beggar, as he threw himself back in the chair, covering his eyes with his hands. The urchin was found to be standing in the middle of the floor, with his little purplish fingers clenched into tight fists, with a truculent nose questing for opposition, breathing heavily, bristling with dead twigs, small, indignant, vulgar and flea-bitten, the hedgehog confronted the committee and faced them down.
"Leave off, Woolly," he demanded. "Stand back, can't he? Give to lad fair play."
And he placed his body sturdily between them and his hero, prepared to knock the first man down who interfered.
"Ah," he said sarcastically, "a fine parcel of boogers, or do say, a fine picking of bumptious pilots for to depose of man, gibble gabble, gibble gabble. But ding the mourner stirs his finger, or us busts on's bloody neck."
Merlin protested miserably.
"Nobody would have wished him to do anything that he did not want."
The hedgehog walked up to him, put his twitching nose to within an inch of the magician's spectacles so that he drew back in alarm, and blew in his face.
"Arr," he said, "nobody wished nothing, never, excepting for to remember as he might have wished something for hisself."
Then he returned to the broken-hearted king, halting at a distance with tact and dignity because of his fleas.
"Nay, meester," he said, "thou hast been within too long. Let thee come out along of an ugly hurchin, that thou mayst sniff God's air to the nostrils and lay thy head to the bosom of the earth. Take no thought for them boogers," he continued. "Lave un for to argify themselves into the high hysterics, that'll plaze un. Let thee smell a peck of air wi' a humble mun, and have thy pleasure of the sky."
Arthur held out his hand for the urchins, who gave it reluctantly after wiping it on the prickles of his back.
"He'm verminous," he explained regretfully, "but he'm honest."
They went together to the door, where the hedgehog, turning round, surveyed the field.
"Au revoir,"
he observed good-humouredly, regarding the committee with ineffable contempt.
"Mind you don't destroy t' universe afore as we comes back. No creating of another, mind."
And he bowed sarcastically to the stricken Merlin.
"God to father."
To the wretched Archimedes, who elongated himself, closed his eyes and looked the other way.
"God to son."
To the imploring badger.
"And God to holy post."
Chapter 18. There is nothing so wonderful as to be out on a spring night in the country, but really in the latest part of the night, and best of all if you can be alone. Then, when you can hear the wild world scamper and the cows chewing just before you tumble over them, and the leaves living secretly, and the nibblings and grass pluckings, and the bloods tied in your own veins, when you can see the loom of trees and hills in deeper darkness, and the stars twirling in their oiled grooves for yourself, when there is one light in one cottage far away, marking a sickness or an early riser upon a mysterious errand, when the horse hoofs with squeaking cart behind plod to an unknown market, dragging their bundled man in sacks asleep, when the dog's chains rattle at the farms and the vixen yelps once and the owls have fallen silent, then is a grand time to be alive and vastly conscious, when all else human is unconscious, homebound, bed-sprawled, at the mercy of the midnight mind. The wind had dropped to rest. The powdery stars expanded and contracted in the serene, making a sight which would have jingled if it had been a sound. The great tor which they were climbing rose against the sky, a murk of majesty, like a horizon which aspired. The little hedgehog, toiling from tussock to tussock, fell into the marshy puddles with grunts, panted as he struggled with the miniature cliffs. The weary king gave him a hand at the worst places, hoisting him into a better foothold or giving him a shove behind, noticing how pathetic and defenceless his bare legs looked from the back. "Thank ye," he said. "Much obliged to some shore." When they had reached the top, he sat down, puffing, and the old man sat beside him to admire the view. It was England that came out slowly, as the late moon rose, his royal realm of gramarye. Stretched at his feet, she spread herself away into the remotest north, leaning towards the imagined Hebrides. She was his homely land. The moon made her trees more important for their shadows than for themselves, picked out the silent rivers in quicksilver, smoothed the toy pasture fields, laid a soft haze on everything. But he felt he would have known the country even without the light. He knew that there must be the Severn, there the Downs, and there the Peak, all invisible to him, but inherent in his home. In this field a white horse must be grazing, in that some washing must be hanging on a hedge. It had a necessity to be itself. He suddenly felt the intense, sad loveliness of being as being, apart from right or wrong, that indeed the mere fact of being was the ultimate right. He began to love the land under him with a fierce longing, not because it was good or bad, but because it was, because of the shadows of the cornstooks on a golden evening, because the sheep's tails would rattle when they ran, and the lambs sucking would revolve their tails in little eddies, because the clouds in daylight would surge it into light and shade, because the squadrons of green and golden plover, worming in the pasture fields, would advance in short, unanimous charges, head to wind, because the spinsterish herons, who keep their hair up with fishbones, according to David Garnett, would fall down in a faint if a boy could stalk them and shout before he was seen, because the smoke from homesteads was a blue beard straying into heaven, because the stars were brighter in puddles than in the sky, because there were puddles and leaky gutters and dunghills with poppies on them, because the salmon in the rivers suddenly leapt and fell, because the chestnut buds in the balmy wind of spring would jump out of their twigs like jacks in boxes, or like little spectres holding up green hands to scare him, because the jackdaws building would hang in the air with branches in their mouths more beautiful than any ark-returning dove, because, in the moonlight there below, God's greatest blessing to the world was stretched, the silver gift of sleep. He found that he loved it, more than Guinevere, more than Lancelot, more than Lioliok. It was his mother and his daughter. He knew the speech of its people, would have felt it change beneath him if he could have shot across it like the goose which once he was, from Zomerzet to Ochai. He could tell how the common people would feel about things, about all sorts of things, before he asked them. He was their king, and they were his people, his own responsibility of Stultus or Ferox, a responsibility like that old goose admiral's upon the farm. They were not ferocious now, because they were asleep. England was at the old man's feet, like a sleeping man-child. When it was awake, it would stump about, grabbing things and breaking them, killing butterflies, pulling the cat's tail, nourishing its ego with amoral and relentless mastery. But in sleep, its masculine force was abdicated. The man-child sprawled undefended now, vulnerable, a baby trusting the world to let it sleep in peace. All the beauty of his humans came upon him, instead of their horribleness. He saw the vast army of martyrs who were his witnesses, young men who had gone out even in the first joy of marriage to be killed on dirty battlefields like Bedegraine for other men's beliefs, but who had gone out voluntarily, but who had gone because they thought it was right, but who had gone although they hated it. They had been ignorant young men, perhaps, and the things which they had died for had been useless. But their ignorance had been innocent. They had done something horribly difficult in their ignorant innocence, which was not for themselves. He suddenly saw all the people who had accepted sacrifice, learned men who had starved for truth, poets who had refused to compound in order to achieve success, parents who had swallowed their own love in order to let their children live, doctors and holy men who had died to help, millions of crusaders, generally stupid, who had been butchered for their stupidity, but who had meant well. That was it, to mean well. He caught a glimpse of that extraordinary faculty in man, that strange, altruistic, rare and obstinate decency, which will make writers or scientists maintain their truths at the risk of death. Eppur si muove, Galileo was to say. It moves all the same. They were to be in a position to burn him if he would go on with it, with his preposterous nonsense about the earth moving round the sun. But he was to continue with the sublime assertion, because there was something which he valued more than himself, the truth, to recognize and to acknowledge what is. That was the thing which man could do, which his English could do, his beloved, his sleeping, his now defenseless English. They might be stupid, ferocious, unpolitical, almost hopeless, but here and there, oh, so seldom, oh, so rare, oh, so glorious, there were those, all the same, who would face the rack, the executioner, and even utter extinction in the cause of something greater than themselves. Truth, that strange thing, the jest of pilots. Many stupid young men had thought they were dying for it, and many would continue to die for it, perhaps for 1,000 years. They did not have to be right about their truth, as Galileo was to be. It was enough that they, the few and martyred, should establish a greatness, a thing above the sum of all they ignorantly had. But then again, there came the wave of sorrow over him. The thought of the man-child when he woke, the thought of that cruel and brutish majority to whom the martyrs were such rare exceptions. It moves for all that. How few, and pitifully few, the ones who would be ready to maintain it. He could have wept for the pity of the world, its horribleness, which still was pitiful. The hedgehog remarked, "Pretty place, an't it?" "Aye, mon, but there is nought that I can do for un." "Tha hast done, champion." a cottage woke in the valley. Its eye of light winked out, and he could feel the man who had made it, a poacher probably, somebody as slow and clumsy and patient as the badger, pulling on his heavy boots. The hedgehog asked, "Shire?" "Sire, mon, and 'tis Majesty, not Maggie's tea."
"Majesty?"
"Aye, mon."
"Dost thou mind as how was used for to sing to un?"
"I minds un well. 'Twas Rustic Bridge and Genevieve and...
Home, sweet home."
The king suddenly bowed his head.
"Shall us sing on for ye again, Majesty mun?"
He could only nod. The hedgehog stood in the moonlight, assuming the proper attitude for song. He planted his feet squarely, folded his hands on his stomach, fixed his eye upon a distant object. Then, in his clear country tenor, he sang for the King of England about home sweet home. The silly, simple music died away. But not silly in the moonlight, not on a mountain of your realm. The hedgehog shuffled, coughed, was wishful for something more. But the king was speechless.
"Majesty,"
he mentioned shyly,
"us got a fresh un."
There was no reply.
"When us knowed as you was a-comin', us land a fresh un. 'Twas for thy welcome, like. Us land it off that there mean."
"Sing it," gasped the old man. He had stretched his bones upon the heather, because it was all too much. And there, upon the height of England, in a good pronunciation, because he had learnt it carefully from Merlin, to parry's music from the future, with his sword of twigs in one grey hand and a chariot of mouldy leaves, the hedgehog stood to build Jerusalem, and meant it. "Bring me my bow of burning gold, bring me my arrows of desire, bring me my spear, O clouds unfold, bring me my chariot of fire. I will not cease from mental strife, nor shall my sword sleep in my hand, till I have built Jerusalem on England's green and pleasant land."
Chapter 19. The pale faces of the committee, hunched round the fire, turned towards the door in a single movement, and six pairs of guilty eyes were fastened on the king. But it was England who came in. There was no need to say anything, no need to explain. They could see it in his face. Then they were rising up and coming towards him and standing round him humbly. Merlin, to his surprise, was an old man with hands which shook like leaves. He was blowing his nose very much indeed on his own skull cap, from which there was falling a perfect shower of mice and frogs. The badger was weeping bitterly and absent-mindedly swatting each tear as it appeared on the end of his nose. Archimedes had turned his head completely back to front to hide his shame. Caval's expression was of torment. T. Natrix had laid his head on the royal foot with one clear tear in each nostril, and Berlin's nictating membrane was going with the speed of the Morse code.
"God save the king," they said.
"You may be seated."
So they sat down deferentially after he had taken the first seat. A privy council.
"We will be returning soon," he said, "to our bright realm. Before we go, there are questions we must ask. In the first place, it has been said that there will be a man like John Ball, who is to be a bad naturalist because he claims that men should live like ants. What is the objection to his claim?"
Merlin stood up and took off his hat.
It is a matter of natural morality, sir. The committee suggests that it is moral for a species to specialize in its own speciality. An elephant must attend to its trunk, a giraffe or camelopard to its neck. It would be immoral for an elephant to fly because it has no wings. The speciality of man, as much developed in him as the neck is in the camelopard, is his neopallium. This is the part of the brain which, instead of being devoted to instinct, is concerned with memory, deduction, and the forms of thought which result in recognition by the individual of his personality. Man's topknot makes him conscious of himself as a separate being, which does not often happen in animals and savages, so that any form of pronounced collectivism in politics is contrary to the specialization of man. This, by the way, continued the old gentleman slowly, drawing a film over his eyes as if he were a weary second-sighted vulture, is why I have, during a lifetime extending backwards over several tiresome centuries, waged my little war against might under all its forms. And it is why I have rightly or wrongly seduced others into waging it. It is why I once persuaded you, sir, to regard the games maniac with contempt, to oppose your wisdom against the Baron of Fort Maine, to believe in justice rather than in power, and to investigate with mental integrity, as we have tried to do this long-drawn evening, the causes of the battle we are waging. For war is force unbridled at a gallop. I have not engaged in this crusade because the fact of force can be considered wrong in an abstract sense. For the boa constrictor, who is practically one enormous muscle, it would be literally true to say that might is right. For the ant, whose brain is not constituted like the human brain, it is literally true that the state is more important than the individual. But for man, whose speciality lies in the personality-recognizing creases of his neopallium, as much developed in him as the muscles are in the boa constrictor, it is equally true to say that mental truth, not force, is right, and that the individual is more important than the state. He is so much more important that he should abolish it. We must leave the boa constrictors to admire themselves for being muscular athletes. Games mania, Fort Maine and so forth are right for them. Perhaps the reticulations of the python are really some form of first 11 jersey. We must leave the ants to assert the glory of the state. Totalitarianism is their line of country, no doubt. But for man, and not on an abstract definition of right and wrong, but on nature's concrete definition that a species must specialize in its own speciality, the committee suggests that might was never right, that the state never excelled the individual, and that the future lies with the personal soul. Perhaps you ought to speak about the brain. Sir, there are a great many things going on in this old brain box, but for the purposes of our investigation, we confine ourselves to two compartments, the neopallium and the corpus striatum. In the latter, to put it simply, my instinctive and mechanical actions are determined. In the former, I keep that reason, in honour of which our race has curiously been nicknamed Sapiens. Perhaps I can explain it with one of those dangerous and often misleading similes. The corpus striatum is like a single mirror which reflects instinctive actions outwards in return for the stimuli which come in. In the neopallium, however, there are two mirrors. They can see each other, and for that reason they know that they exist. Man, know thyself, said somebody or other. Or, as another philosopher had put it, the proper study of mankind is man. This is because he is specialized in the Neopallium. In brainy animals other than man, the emphasis is not on the double-mirrored room, but on the single one. Few animals, except man, are conscious of their own personality. Even in primitive races of the human family, there still exists a confusion between the individual and his surroundings. For the savage Indian, as you may know, distinguishes so little between himself and the outside world that he himself will spit if he wants the clouds to rain. The ant's nervous system may be said to be a single mirror, like the savage's, and that is why it suits the ant to be a communist, to lose himself in a crowd. But it is because civilized man's brain is a double mirror that he will always have to specialize in individuality, in recognition of himself, or whatever you may like to call it. It is because of the two mirrors reflecting each other that he can never wholly succeed as an unselfish member of the proletariat. He must have a self, and all that goes with a self so highly developed, including selfishness and property. Pray forgive my simile if I have seemed to use it unfairly.
Has the goose a Neopallium? Merlin stood up again.
Yes, a fairly good one for a bird. The ants have a different form of nervous system on the lines of the corpora striata.
The second question deals with war. It has been suggested that we ought to abolish it in one way or another, but nobody has given it the chance to speak for itself. Perhaps there is something to be said in favour of war. We would like to be told.
Merlin put his hat on the floor and whispered to the badger, who, after scuttling off to his pile of agenda, returned, to the wonder of all, with the proper piece of paper.
Sir, this question has been before the attention of the committee, who have ventured to draw up a list of pros and cons, which we are ready to recite.
Merlin cleared his throat and announced in a loud voice,
Pro!
In favour of war, explained the badger.
Number one, said Merlin. War is one of the mainsprings of romance. Without war, there would be no Rolands, Maccabees, Lawrences or Hodsons of Hodson's Horse. There would be no Victoria Crosses. It is a stimulant to so-called virtues such as courage and cooperation. In fact, war has moments of glory. It should also be noted that without war, we should lose at least one half of our literature. Shakespeare is packed with it. Number two. War is a way of keeping down the population, though it is a hideous and inefficient one. The same Shakespeare, who seems on the subject of war to have been in agreement with the Germans and with their raving apologist Nietzsche, says in a scene which he is supposed to have written for Beaumont and Fletcher that it heals with blood the earth when it is sick and cures the world of the pleurisy of people. Perhaps I may mention in parentheses, without irreverence, that the bard seems to have been curiously insensitive on the subject of warfare. King Henry V is the most revolting play I know, as Henry himself is the most revolting character. Number three. War does provide a vent for the pent-up ferocity of man, and while man remains a savage, something of the sort seems to be needed. The committee finds, from an examination of history, that human cruelty will vent itself in one way if it is denied another. During the 18th and 19th centuries, when war was a limited exercise confined to professional armies recruited from the criminal classes, the general mass of the population resorted to public executions, dental operations without anaesthetics, brutal sports, and flogging their children. In the 20th century, when war was extended to embrace the masses, hanging, hacking, cockfighting, and spanking went out of fashion. Number 4. The committee is at present occupied about a complicated investigation into the physical or psychological necessity. We do not feel that a report can be made at this stage with profit, but we think we have observed that war does answer a real need in man, perhaps connected with the ferocity mentioned in Article 3, but perhaps not. It has come to our notice that man becomes restless or dejected after a generation of peace. The immortal, if not omniscient, Swan of Avon remarks that peace seems to breed a disease which, coming to a head in a sort of ulcer, bursts out into war. War, he says, is the imposthume of much wealth and peace, which only breaks, showing no outward cause why the man dies. Under this interpretation, it is the peace which is regarded as a slow disease, while the bursting of the imposthume, the war, must be assumed to be beneficial rather than the reverse. The committee has suggested two ways in which wealth and peace might destroy the race if war were prevented: by emasculating it, or by rendering it comatose through glandular troubles. On the subject of emasculation, it should be noted that wars double the birth rate. The reason why women tolerate war is because it promotes virility in men. Number 5. Finally, there is the suggestion, which would probably be made by every other animal on the face of this earth except man, namely, that war is an inestimable boon to creation as a whole, because it does offer some faint hope of exterminating the human race. "Con," announced the magician, but the king prevented him. "We know the objections," he said. "The idea that it is useful might be considered a little more. If there is some necessity for might, why is the committee ready to stop it?"
"Sir, the committee is attempting to trace the physiological basis, possibly of a pituitary or adrenal origin. Possibly the human system requires periodical doses of adrenaline in order to remain healthy. The Japanese, as an instance of glandular activity, are said to eat large quantities of fish, which, by charging their bodies with iodine, expands their thyroids and makes them touchy. Until this matter has been properly investigated, the subject remains vague. But the committee desires to point out that the physiological need could be supplied by other means. War, it has already been observed, is an inefficient way of keeping down the population. It may also be an inefficient way of stimulating the adrenal glands through fear."
"What other ways?"
"Under the Roman Empire, the experiment of offering bloody spectacles in the circus was attempted as a substitute. They provided the purgation which Aristotle talks about, and some such alternative might be found efficient. Science, however, would suggest more radical cures. Either the glandular deficiency might be supplied by periodical injections of the whole population with adrenaline, or with whatever the deficiency may prove to be, or else some form of surgery might be found effective. Perhaps the root of war is removable, like the appendix."
"We were told that war is caused by national property. Now we are told it is due to a gland."
"Sir, the two things may be related, although they may not be consequent upon one another. For instance, if wars were solely due to national property, we should expect them to continue without intermission, so long as national property continued, that is, all the time. We find, however, that they are interrupted by frequent lulls, called peace.
It seems as if the human race becomes more and more comatose during those periods of truce, until, when what you call the saturation point of adrenaline deficiency has been reached, it seizes upon the first handy excuse for a good shot of fear stimulant. The handy excuse is national property. Even if the wars are dolled up as religious ones, such as crusades against Saladin or the Albigensians or Montezuma, the basis remains the same. Nobody would have troubled to extend the benefits of Christianity to Montezuma if his sandals had not been made of gold. And nobody would have thought the gold itself a sufficient temptation if they had not been needing a dose of adrenaline.
You suggest an alternative like the circus, pending the investigation of your gland. Have you considered it?
Archimedes giggled unexpectedly.
Merlin wants to have an international fair, sir. He wants to have a lot of flip-flaps and giant wheels and scenic railways in a reservation, and they are all to be slightly dangerous, so as to kill perhaps one man in 100. Entrance is to be voluntary, for he says that the one unutterably wicked thing about a war is conscription. He says that people will go to the fair of their own free will, through boredom or through adrenaline deficiency or whatever it is, and that they are likely to feel the need for it during their 25th, 30th, and 45th years. It is to be made fashionable and glorious to go. Every visitor will get a commemorative medal, while those who go 50 times will get what he calls the DSO, or the VC for 100 visits.
The magician looked ashamed and cracked his fingers.
The suggestion, he said humbly, was more to provoke thought than to be thought of.
Certainly it does not seem a practical suggestion for the present year of grace. Are there no panaceas for war which could be used in the meantime?
The committee has suggested an antidote which might have a temporary effect, like soda for an acid stomach. It would be of no use as a cure for the malady, though it might alleviate it. It might save a few million lives in a century.
What is this antidote?
Sir, you will have noticed that the people who are responsible for the declaration and the higher conduct of wars do not tend to be the people who endure their extremes. At the Battle of Bedegraine, your Majesty dealt with something of the same sort. The kings and the generals and the leaders of battles have a peculiar aptitude for not being killed in them. The committee has suggested that after every war, all the officials on the losing side who held a higher rank than colonel ought to be executed out of hand, irrespective of their war guilt. No doubt there would be a certain amount of injustice in this measure, but the consciousness that death was the certain result of losing a war would have a deterrent effect on those who helped to promote and to regulate such engagements. And it might, by preventing a few wars, save millions of lives among the lower classes. Even a Führer like Mordred might think twice about heading hostilities if he knew that his own execution would be the result of being unlucky in them.
It seems reasonable.
It is less reasonable than it seems, partly because the responsibility for warfare does not lie wholly with the leaders. After all, a leader has to be chosen or accepted by those whom he leads. The hydra-headed multitudes are not so innocent as they like to pretend. They have given a mandate to their generals, and they must abide by the moral responsibility.
Still, it would have the effect of making the leaders reluctant to be pushed into warfare by their followers, and even that would help.
It would help. The difficulty would lie in persuading the leading classes to agree to such a convention in the first place. Also,
I am afraid that you will find there is always a type of maniac, anxious for notoriety at any price, or even for martyrdom, who would accept the pomp of leadership with even greater alacrity because it was enhanced by melodramatic penalties. The kings of Irish mythology were compelled by their station to march in the forefront of the battle, which occasioned a frightful mortality among them, yet there never seems to have been a lack of kings or battles in the history of the Green Isle.
"What about this new-fangled law?" asked the goat suddenly, "which our king has been inventing. If individuals can be deterred from murder by fear of a death penalty, why cannot there be an international law under which nations can be deterred from war by similar means? An aggressive nation might be kept at peace by the knowledge that, if it began a war, some international police force would sentence it to dispersal by mass transportation to other countries, for instance."
"There are two objections to that. First, you would be trying to cure the disease, not to prevent it. Second, we know from experience that the existence of a death penalty does not, in fact, abolish murder. It might, however, prove to be a temporary step in the right direction."
The old man folded his hands in his sleeves like a Chinaman and looked round the council table doggedly, waiting for further questions. His eyes had begun to discharge their watch.
"He has been writing a book called The Libellus Merlini, The Prophecies of Merlin," continued Archimedes wickedly, when he saw that this subject had been concluded, "which he had intended to read aloud to your Majesty as soon as you arrived."
"We will hear a reading." Merlin wrung his hands.
"Sir," he said, "it is mere fortune-telling, only gypsy tricks. It had to be written because there was a good deal of fuss about it in the 12th century, after which we are to lose sight of it until the 20th. But, oh, sir, it is merely a parlour game, not worth your Majesty's attention at present."
"Read me some part of it, nonetheless." So the humiliated scientist, all of whose quips and quiddities had been knocked out of him in the last hour, fetched the burned manuscript from the fender and handed round a collection of such slips as were still legible, as if it had been a parlour game in earnest. The animals read them out in turn, like mottoes from crackers, and this is what they said. "God will provide," the dodo will remark. "The bear will cure his headache by cutting off his head, but it will leave him with a sore behind.
The lion will lie down with the eagle, saying, 'At last all the animals are united,' but the devil will see the joke. The stars which taught the sun to rise must agree with him at noon or vanish. A child standing in Broadway will cry, 'Look, mother, there is a man.' How long it takes to build Jerusalem," the spider will say, pausing exhausted at his web on the ground floor of the Empire State Building.
"Living space leads to space for the coffin," observed the beetle.
"Force makes force.
Wars of community, county, country, creed, continent, colour. After that, the hand of God, if not before.
Imitation, mimesis, before action, will save mankind. The elk died because it grew its horns too big.
No collision with the moon was required to exterminate the mammoth.
The destiny of all species is extinction as such, fortunately for them."
There was a pause after the last motto, while the listeners thought them over. "What is the meaning of the one with the Greek word?"
"Sir, a part of its meaning, but only a small part, is that the one hope for our human race must lie in education without coercion.
Confucius has it that, in order to propagate virtue to the world, one must first rule one's country. In order to rule one's country, one must first rule one's family. In order to rule one's family, one must first regulate one's body by moral training. In order to regulate one's body, one must first regulate one's mind. In order to regulate the mind, one must first be sincere in one's intentions. In order to be sincere in one's intentions, one must first increase one's knowledge.
I see. Have the rest any relevant meaning? Added the king.
None whatever.
One further question before we rise. You have said that politics are out of order, but they seem so closely tied to the question of warfare that they must be faced to some extent. At an earlier stage, you claim to be a capitalist. Are you sure of these views?
If I said so, Your Majesty, I did not mean it. Badger was talking at me like a communist of the 1920s, which made me talk like a capitalist in self-defense. I am an anarchist, like any other sensible person. In point of fact, the race will find that capitalists and communists modify themselves so much during the ages that they end by being indistinguishable as democrats. And so will the fascists modify themselves, for that matter. But whatever may be the contortions adopted by these three brands of collectivism, and however many the centuries during which they butcher each other out of childish ill-temper, the fact remains that all forms of collectivism are mistaken according to the human skull. The destiny of man is an individualistic destiny, and it is in that sense that I may have implied a qualified approval of capitalism, if I did imply it. The despised Victorian capitalist, who did at least allow a good deal of play to the individual, was probably more truly futuristic in his politics than all the new orders shrieked for in the 20th century. He was of the future, because individualism lies in the future of the human brain. He was not so old-fashioned as the fascists and the communists, but of course he was considerably old-fashioned for all that, and that is why I prefer myself to be an anarchist. That is, to be a little up-to-date. The geese are anarchists, you remember. They realize that the moral sense must come from inside, not from outside.
I thought, said the badger plaintively, that communism was supposed to be a step towards anarchy. I thought that when communism had been properly achieved, the state would wither away.
People have told me so, but I doubt it. I cannot see how you may emancipate an individual by first creating an omnipotent state. There are no states in nature, except among monstrosities like the ants. It seems to me that people who go creating states, as Mordred is trying to do with his thrashers, must tend to become involved in them, and so unable to escape. But perhaps what you say is true. I hope it is. In any case, let us leave these dubious questions of politics to the dingy tyrants who look after them. 10,000 years from now, it may be time for the educated to concern themselves with such things, but meanwhile they must wait for the race to grow up. We, for our part, have offered a solution this evening to the special problem of force as an arbiter. The obvious platitude that war is due to national property, with the rider that it is stimulated by certain glands. Let us leave it at that for the present, in God's name.
The old magician swept his notes away with a trembling hand. He had been deeply wounded by the hedgehog's earlier criticisms, because, in the secrecy of his heart, he loved his student dearly. He knew now, since the royal hero had returned victorious in his choice, that his own wisdom was not the end.
He knew that he had finished his tutorship. Once he had told the king that he would never be the wart again. But it had been an encouraging thing to say. He had not meant it. Now he did mean it. Now knew that he himself had yielded place, had stepped down from the authority to lead or to direct. The abdication had cost him his gaiety. He would not be able to rant any more, or to twinkle and mystify with the flashing folds of his magic cloak. The condescension of learning was pricked in him. He was feeling ancient and ashamed. The old king, whose childhood had vanished also, toyed with a slip left on the table. He was at his trick of watching his hands when in abstraction. He folded the paper this way, that way, carefully, and unfolded it. It was one of Merlin's notes for the card index, which Badger had muddled with the prophecies. A quotation from a historian called Friar Clin, who had died in 1348. This friar, employed as the analyst of his abbey to keep the historical records, had seen the Black Death coming to fetch him, possibly to fetch the whole world, for it had killed a third of the population of Europe already. Carefully leaving some pieces of blank parchment with the book in which he was to write no longer, he had concluded with the following message, which had once awakened Merlin's strange respect. "Seeing these many ills," he had written in Latin, "and, as it were, the whole world thrust into malignancy, waiting among the dead for death to come to me, I have put into writing what I have truthfully heard and examined. And lest the writing should perish with the writer, or the work fail with the workman, I am now leaving some paper for the continuation of it, in case, by any chance, a man may remain alive in the future, or any person of the race of Adam may escape this pestilence, to carry on the labour once begun by me." The king folded it neatly, measured it on the table. They watched him, knowing he was about to rise and ready to follow his example. "Very good," he said. "We understand the puzzle." He tapped the table with the paper, then got to his feet. "We must return before the morning." The animals were rising too. They were conducting him to the door, crowding round him to kiss his hand and bid farewell. His now retired tutor, who must conduct him home, was holding the door for him to pass. Whether he was a dream or not, he had begun to flicker, as had they all. They were saying, "Good success to your majesty, a speedy and successful issue." He smiled gravely, saying, "We hope it will be speedy." But he was referring to his death, as one of them knew. "It is only for this time, Majesty," said Teenatrix. "You remember the story of St. George, and Homo sapiens is like that still. You will fail because it is the nature of man to slay in ignorance, if not in wrath. But failure builds success, and nature changes. A good man's example always does instruct the ignorant and lessens their rage, little by little through the ages, until the spirit of the waters is content. And so, strong courage to your majesty, and a tranquil heart." He inclined his head to the one who knew, and turned to go. At the last moment, a hand was tugging at his sleeve, reminding him of the friend he had forgotten. He lifted the hedgehog with both hands under its armpits and held it at arm's length, face to face. "Ah, Tiggy," he said, "us have thee to thank for royalty. Farewell, Tiggy, and a merry life to thee and thy sweet songs." But the hedgehog paddled its feet as if it were bicycling, because it wanted to be put down. It tugged the sleeve again when it was safe upon the floor, and the old man lowered his head to hear the whisper.
"Nay, nay," it mentioned hoarsely, clutching his hand, looking earnestly in his face. "Say not farewell."
It tugged again, dropping its voice to the brink of silence.
"Orivoya," whispered the urchin. "Orivoya."
Chapter 20. Well, we have reached it at last, the end of our winding story. Arthur of England went back to the world to do his duty as well as he could. He called a truce with Mordred, having made up his mind that he must offer half his kingdom for the sake of peace. To tell the truth, he was prepared to yield it all if necessary. As a possession, it had long ceased to be of value to him, and he had come to know for sure that peace was more important than a kingdom. But he felt it was his duty to retain a half if he could. And it was for this reason, that if he had even half a world to work on, he might be able still to introduce in it the germs of that good sense which he had learned from geese and animals. The truce was made, the armies drawn up in their battles face to face. Each had a standard made from a ship's mast, set on wheels, at the top of which a small box held the consecrated host, while from the masts there flew the banners of the dragon and the thistle. The knights of Mordred's party were dressed in sable armour, their plumes were sable also, and on their arms the scarlet whip of Mordred's badge glared with the sinister tint of blood. Perhaps they looked more terrible than they felt. It was explained to the waiting ranks that none of them must make a hostile demonstration, but all must keep their swords in sheath. Only, for fear of treachery, it was told that they might charge to rescue if any sword was seen unharnessed at the parley. Arthur went forward to the space between the armies with his staff, and Mordred, with his own staff in their black accoutrements, came out to meet him. They encountered, and the old king saw his son's face once again. It was taut and haggard. He too, poor man, had strayed beyond sorrow and solitude to the country of Kennaquhair. But he had gone without a guide and lost his way. The treaty was agreed on, to the surprise of all, more easily than had been hoped. The king was left with half his realm. For a moment, joy and peace were in the balance. But at that knife edge of a moment, the old Adam reared itself in a different form. The feudal war, baronial oppression, individual might, even ideological rebellion, he had settled them all in one way or another, only to be beaten on the last lap now by the episodic fact that man was a slayer by instinct. A grass snake moved in the meadow near their feet, close to an officer of Mordred's staff. This officer stepped back instinctively and swung his hand across his body, his armlet with the whip showing for a second's flash. The bright sword flamed into being to destroy the so-called viper. The waiting armies, taking it for treachery, raised their shout of rage. The lances on both sides bowed to rest, and as King Arthur ran towards his own array, an old man with white hair trying to stem the endless tide, holding out the knuckled hands in a gesture of pressing them back, struggling to the last against the flood of might which had burst out all his life at a new place whenever he had dammed it. So the tumult rose, the war yells sounded, and the meeting waters closed above his head. Lancelot arrived too late. He had made his best speed, but it had been in vain. All he could do was to pacify the country and give burial to the dead. Then, when a semblance of order had been restored, he hurried to Guinevere.
She was supposed to be in the Tower of London still, for Mordred's siege had failed. But Guinevere had gone. In those days the rules of convents were not so strict as they are now. Often they were more like hostelries for their well-born patrons. Guinevere had taken the veil at Amesbury. She felt that they had suffered enough and had caused enough suffering to others. She refused to see her ancient lover or to talk it over. She said, which was patently untrue, that she wished to make her peace with God. Guinevere never cared for God. She was a good theologian, but that was all. The truth was that she was old and wise. She knew that Lancelot did care for God most passionately, that it was essential he should turn in that direction. So for his sake, to make it easier for him, the great queen now renounced what she had fought for all her life, now set the example and stood to her choice. She had stepped out of the picture. Lancelot guessed a good deal of this, and when she refused to see him, he climbed the convent wall with Gallic, aging gallantry. He waylaid her to expostulate, but she was adamant and brave. Something about Mordred seems to have broken her lust for life. They parted, never to meet on earth. Guinevere became a worldly abbess. She ruled her convent efficiently, royally, with a sort of grand contempt. The little pupils of the school were brought up in the great tradition of nobility. They saw her walking in the grounds, upright, rigid, her fingers flashing with hard rings, her linen clean and fine and scented, against the rules of her order. The novices worshipped her unanimously with schoolgirl passions and whispered about her past. She became a grand old lady. When she died at last, her Lancelot came for the body, with his snow-white hair and wrinkled cheeks, to carry it to her husband's grave. There, in the reputed grave, she was buried, a calm and regal face, nailed down and hidden in the earth. As for Lancelot, he became a hermit in earnest. With seven of his own knights as companions, he entered a monastery near Glastonbury and devoted his life to worship. Arthur, Guinevere, and Elaine were gone, but his ghostly love remained. He prayed for all of them twice a day, with all his never-beaten might, and lived in glad austerities apart from man. He even learned to distinguish bird songs in the woods, and to have time for all the things which had been denied to him by Uncle Dapp. He became an excellent gardener, and a reputed saint. Ipse, says a medieval poem about another old crusader, a great lord like Lancelot in his day, and one who also retired from the world. Ipse post militiae cursum temporalis illustratus gratia doni spiritualis, esse Christi cupiens mille specialis, in hac domo monarchus factus est claustralis. He, after the bustle of temporal warfare, enlightened with the grace of a spiritual gift, covetous to be the special soldier of Christ, in this house was made a cloistered monk. More than usually placid, gentle and benign, as white as a swan on account of his old age, bland and affable and lovable, he possessed in himself the grace of the Holy Spirit. For he often frequented Holy Church, joyfully listened to the mysteries of the Mass, proclaimed such praises as he was able, and mentally ruminated the heavenly glory. His gentle and jocose conversation, highly commendable and religious, was thus pleasing to the whole fraternity, because it was neither stuffy nor squeamish. Here, as often as he rambled across the cloister, he bowed from side to side to the monks, and he saluted with a bob of his head thus, the ones whom he loved most intimately. Hic per claustrum, quotiens transiens meavit, Hinc et hinc ad monarchos caput inclinavit, et sic nutu capitis eos salutavit, quos affectu intimo plurimum amavit. When his own death hour came, it was accompanied by visions in the monastery. The old abbot dreamt of bells sounding most beautifully, and of angels with happy laughter hauling Lancelot to heaven. They found him dead in his cell, in the act of accomplishing the third and last of his miracles, for he had died in what was called the odour of sanctity. When saints die, their bodies fill the room with lovely scent, perhaps of new hay, or of blossom in the spring, or of the clean seashore. Hector pronounced his brother's keen, one of the most touching pieces of prose in the language. He said, "Ah, Lancelot, thou wert head of all Christian knights, and now I dare say, thou, Sir Lancelot, there thou liest, that thou were never matched of earthly knight's hand, and thou were the courtliest knight that ever bare shield, and thou were the truest friend of thy lover that ever bestrode horse, and thou were the truest lover of a sinful man that ever loved woman, and thou were the kindest man that ever strake with sword, and thou were the godliest person that ever came among press of knights, and thou were the meekest man and gentlest that ever ate in hall among ladies, and thou were the sternest knight to thy mortal foe that ever put spear in rest." The Round Table had been smashed at Salisbury, its few survivors thinning out as the years went by. At last there were only four of them left: Boar, the misogynist, Bleobaris, Hector, and Damaris. These old men made a pilgrimage to the Holy Land for the repose of the souls of all their comrades, and there they died upon a Good Friday for God's sake, the last of the Round Table. Now there are none of them left, only knights of the Bath and of other orders degraded by comparison. About King Arthur of England, that gentle heart and centre of it all, there remains a mystery to this day. Some think that he and Mordred perished on each other's swords. Robert of Thornton mentions that he was attended by a surgeon of Salerno, who found by examination of his wounds that he could never be whole again. So he said, "In manus," boldly on the place where he lay, and spake no more. Those who adhere to this account claim that he was buried at Glastonbury under a stone which said, "Hic jacet Arturus, rex quondam, rex quae futurus." Here lies Arthur, the once and future king. And that his body was exhumed by Henry II as a counterblast to Welsh nationalism, for the Cymry were claiming even then that the great king had never perished. They believed that he would come again to lead them, and they also mendaciously asserted, as usual, his British nationality. Adam of Domerham tells us, on the other hand, that the exhumation took place in April 1278 under Edward I, and that he himself was a witness of the proceedings, while it is known that a third search took place in vain under Edward III, who, by the way, revived the Round Table in 1344 as a serious order of knighthood, like the Garter. Whatever the real date may have been, tradition has it that the bones, when exhumed, were of gigantic stature, and Guinevere's had golden hair. Then there is another tale, widely supported, that our hero was carried away to the Vale of Avalach by a collection of queens in a magic boat. These are believed to have ferried him across the Severn to their own country, there to heal him of his wounds. The Italians have got hold of an idea about a certain Arturo Magno, who was translated to Mount Etna, where he can still be seen occasionally, they say. Don Quixote, the Spaniard, a very learned gentleman, indeed he went mad on account of it, maintains that he became a raven, an assertion which may not seem so wholly ridiculous to those who have read our little story. Then there are the Irish, who have muddled him up with one of the Fitzgeralds, and declare that he rides round a rath with sword upraised to the Londonderry heir. The Scots, who have a legend about Arthur Knicht, who raid on Knicht, wi gilten spoor and candlelicht, still swear to him in Edinburgh, where they believe that he presides from Arthur's seat. The Bretons claim to have heard his horn and to have seen his armour, and they also believe he will return. A book called The High History of the Holy Grail, which was translated by an irascible scholar called Dr. Sebastian Evans, says, on the contrary, that he was safely buried in a house of religion that standeth at the head of the Moors Adventurous. A Miss Jessie L. Weston mentions a manuscript which she pleases to call 1533, supported by Le Mort d'Arthur, in which it is stated that the queen who came to carry him away was none other than the aged enchantress Morgan, his half-sister, and that she took him to a magic island. Dr. Sommer regards the entire account as absurd. A lot of people called Wolfram von Eschenbach, Ulrich von Satzighoven, Dr. Wexler, Professor Zimmer, Mr. Nutt, and so forth, either scout the question wholly or remain in learned confusion. Chaucer, Spenser, Shakespeare, Milton, Wordsworth, Tennyson, and a number of other reliable witnesses agree that he is still on earth, Milton inclining to the view that he is underneath it. Arthurumque etiam sub terris bella moventem, and Arthur too stirring up wars beneath the earth, while Tennyson is of the opinion that he will come again to visit us like a modern gentleman of stateliest port, possibly like the Prince Consort. Shakespeare's contribution is to place the beloved Falstaff at his death not in Abraham's, but in Arthur's bosom. The legends of the common people are beautiful, strange, and positive. Gervase of Tilbury, writing in 1212, says that in the woods of Britain, the foresters tell that on alternate days, about noon or at midnight, when the moon is full and shiny, they often see an array of huntsmen who, in answer to inquirers, say they are of the household and fellowship of Arthur. These, however, were probably real bands of Saxon poachers, like the followers of Robin Hood, who had named their gang in honour of the ancient king. The men of Devon are accustomed to point out the chair and oven of Arthur among the rocks of their coast. In Somersetshire there are some villages called East and West Camel Ott, mentioned by Leland, which are beset with legends of a king still sitting in a golden crown. It is to be noted that the river Ivel, whence, according to Drayton, our knightly deeds and brave achievements sprung, is in the same country. So is South Cadbury, whose rector reports his parishioners as relating how folks do say that in the night of the full moon King Arthur and his men ride round the hill, and their horses are shod with silver, and a silver shoe has been found in the track where they do ride, and when they have ridden round the hill they do stop to water their horses at the wishing well. Finally, there is the little village of Bodmin in Cornwall, whose inhabitants are certain that the king inhabits a local tumulus. In 1113 they even assaulted, within the sanctuary, a party of monks from Brittany, an unheard-of thing to do, because they had thrown doubts upon the legend. It has to be admitted that some of these dates scarcely fit in with the thorny subject of Arthurian chronology. And Malory, that great man who is the noblest source of all this history, maintains a discreet reserve. As for myself, I cannot forget the hedgehog's last farewell, coupled with Quixote's hint about the animals and Milton's subterranean dream. It is little more than a theory, but perhaps the inhabitants of Bodmin will look at their tumulus, and if it is like an enormous molehill with a dark opening in its side, particularly if there are some badger tracks in the vicinity, we can draw our own conclusions. For I am inclined to believe that my beloved Arthur of the future is sitting at this very moment among his learned friends in the combination room of the College of Life, and that they are thinking away in there for all they are worth about the best means to help our curious species. And I, for one, hope that some day, when not only England but the world has need of them, and when it is ready to listen to reason, if it ever is, they will issue from their wrath in joy and power. And then, perhaps, they will give us happiness in the world once more, and chivalry, and the old medieval blessing of certain simple people, who tried, at any rate, in their own small way, to still the ancient brutal dream of Attila the Hun. Explicit liber regis quondam, graviter et laboriose scriptus inter annos 1090 trigenta sex et 1090 quadraginta duo, nationibus indiro bello curtantibus. Hic etiam incipit, si forte in futuro, homo superstis pestilentiam possit evadere, et opus continuare inceptum spes regis futuri. Ora pro toma malore equite, discipuloque humilii eius, qui nunc sua sponte libros deponit, ut pro specie pugnet. Here ends the book of the one-time king, written with much toil and effort between the years 1936 and 1942, when the nations were striving in fearful warfare. Here also begins, if perchance a man may in future time survive the pestilence and continue the task he has begun, the hope of the future king. Pray for Thomas Malory, knight, and his humble disciple, who now voluntarily lays aside his books to fight for his kind.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.